This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled weekend. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for conversation with an acclaimed jazz drummer, a look behind the scenes at a ballet company at the forefront of American dance, or a celebration of the arts with a splash of red, we've got answers. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Get ready to stretch your imagination as the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet is heading back to the Crescent City with a stunning repertoire. We caught up with artistic director Tom Mossbrucker by phone. Tom, can you tell me about Aspen Santa Fe Ballet? It's known for its innovative style and sophisticated repertoire. What will you explore in this follow-up visit to New Orleans?
Well, we're currently in our 17th season, and you're right, we've sort of become known for having a unique repertoire and a unique company. A lot of people think that we're modern-based, and we're actually classically-based, and you're going to see that in the performance that we do. One of the pieces is even danced on point.
You're known for commissioning new works from top choreographers, and you open with an imaginative work called Square Nun. Tell us about this piece and the choreographer.
Well, in 17 years, we've commissioned 24 ballets, which is a pretty big achievement. And this ballet, Square Nun, is one of our really success stories in that he's a young choreographer. We were the first company to commission him. We got him right out of Juilliard, this young 22-year-old. His name is Norbert de la Cruz, and we found him hugely talented. We commissioned him right away.
Tell us more about Square Nun. What is it about, and what will we see?
All the works that we do are abstract. There's no story. People often go away saying, what was the story of that? What was the story of that? And I'll often tell them, you know, think of it as if you're looking at a piece of contemporary art. There's not a story to it, but there's an inspiration. And I think, you know, Norbert being a young choreographer, had lots and lots and lots of ideas and inspiration. And so the piece kind of reflects that point of view of a young man and all of his different inspirations. And, you know, we kept telling him, you know, do less, do less, do less. But I think when you see the piece, you see it just flows from one idea to another very seamlessly, actually. I often talk about it that it's like a journey. The way you put the music together is a musical collage of some electronic music, some opera singing, and some Baroque music. It's really beautiful the way he put that all together.
I understand the piece is also quite athletic.
It's athletic. It has a gorgeous lighting design, and, you know, people always talk about that piece. It's a great piece to open the program.
And the centerpiece, Return to a Strange Land.
Return to a Strange Land is by one of the greatest choreographers of our time, one of the greatest living choreographers, Yuri Kilian, who's a Czechoslovakian choreographer and, of course, was many years in Holland, Netherlands Dance Theater. The inspiration is very defined. It was his mentor as a choreographer was John Cranko of the Stuttgart Ballet. And John Cranko died suddenly at age 42. And he was really instrumental in Yuri's development as a choreographer. And it was a very, very emotional time for Yuri. And he did this piece as an homage to John Cranko. And so there's lots of images of passing and death and moving on. But there's also images of life and rebirth. And the idea behind the title was that we come from a place that we don't really know. And when we pass on, we return to that place. It's a strange place because we don't really know it and we don't know what to expect. So there's lots of really, really beautiful images of birth and death. Very poetic. It's only two women and four men. And this is the piece that's danced on point.
And this is danced to music by Leos Janáček?
Yes, a Czechoslovakian composer. The two of them did many ballets together.
And the finale, I understand, is quite colorful.
The finale is by a Finnish choreographer named Jorma Elo. It's interesting because Jorma was a dancer for Kilian for many, many years, and Yuri Kilian was sort of the mentor for Jorma. And so over the years, he's done four ballets for us, and this last one is called Overglow, and it's to music by Mendelssohn and Beethoven. And it's really a joyous piece. It was really a gift to our dancers because he knows them so well over the years, and he really created each dancer has a specific feel and character, and he really keyed into the dancer's strength. I just love this piece. It's bright and colorful.
Uh-huh. You're a former principal dancer with the Joffrey Ballet, and you also have danced in works by some of the choreographers associated with this upcoming New Orleans performance.
I actually did two parts in Return to the Strange Land. That ballet is really close to my heart, but the other two, you know, are newer works, and they were commissioned especially for our companies. But one of the things I got from the Joffrey was really, I danced with the Joffrey in the 80s, and that was an incredibly rich time. You know, Mr. Joffrey was still living, and he believed so strongly in embracing the modern dance world and bringing it into the classical ballet world. And so it was just an incredible inspiration. We worked with virtually every major choreographer you could think of, from Mark Morris to Paul Taylor to Twilight Barr to Cranko. I mean, we did everything in the 80s. And so I really came away with a vast vocabulary of ideas and work.
What are you hoping audiences will take away from this experience?
I hope that they're touched and that they're moved. Each piece is very different, and I know that they'll be touched by one or two or all three of them.
Oh, that's beautiful. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Aspen Santa Fe Ballet Artistic Director Tom Mossbrucker. The New Orleans Ballet Association, NOBA, presents the return of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet in an evening of dance at the Mahalia Jackson Theater, Saturday, February 23rd, 8 p.m. Herlin Riley is one of the world's finest drummers, the sort of fully engaged performer whose blend of passion, expertise, and palpable joy is irresistible. He recently sat down with WWNO's Fred Kasten for the Talkin' Jazz interview series at the old U.S. Mint and talked about the profound role that family played in shaping his life in music.
Herlin Riley grew up on Delray Street in the Lower Ninth Ward. Cradled in the sound of his uncles, saxophonist David Lasty, trumpeter Melvin Lasty, and drummer Walter Poppy Lasty, rehearsing their jazz band.
A combo called the Lasty Brothers Combo. And, you know, that's the first time I heard moaning, like, you know, Art Blakey's The Jazz Messengers. I heard a lot of that music, but I heard it live because my uncles were rehearsing it in the house. And, it was at my grandparents' house, 1807 Delray Street in Lower Ninth. And they would be rehearsing the music in the house. And my mother tells me that sometimes I'd be crying and they would just roll my crib into the room where they were rehearsing, and I would kind of be my pacifier, kind of shut me up, you know. So the music was always a part of me, you know. A lot of my friends ask me, man, how did you learn how to play jazz? I say, well, I don't know, it was just there. And, you know, the feeling and the groove of the music was always there for me. And, you know, my uncle's just, you know, it was just like somebody asked you, when did you learn to talk? You don't know. You just, you know, someone spoke to you and you heard it and then you gave it back.
Was the drum the first thing that you played as a kid?
Yes, the drums. Well, the first thing I played was my grandmother's pots and pans. And then, you know. Eventually, yeah, I got to the drums, and you know, and most of my drumming playing, you know, in my early years was in the church, you know, because my grandfather was, you know, he was a deacon in the church, and he was like one of the first people to bring the drums into the church in New Orleans, so when he'd play, you know, I'd be sitting there like, you know, just like a child, man, I'd just be waiting, twiddling my thumbs, waiting, you know. I'm in the spirit of the music as well, but I want to get to the drums. And when he got up from the drums to speak or something, then that was my opportunity, and I'd sit down and let me play. And, you know, he would always, you know, sometimes he'd fuss at me because, you know, as a young kid growing up, I'm hearing all kind of music on the radio. I'm hearing Fats Domino, and I'm hearing James Brown. I'm hearing all these, you know, all these different kind of grooves. And so the playing in the church was really my only chance to get to play the drums. So sometimes I'd be playing the drums and, you know, playing the church groove and that kind of thing. And I'd switch over and play like a James Brown Cold Sweat. My grandfather would say, boy, don't do that. That's not the place for this. Don't do that in here. You just play time, you know. So I'd go back. And so it was a great experience also. And it taught me that, you know, how to there are certain styles of music that's functional with that works with certain styles, you know. And I've been very fortunate to play a lot of different styles of music. I'm related also to Jesse Hill, the guy who made Oopoopadoo, and anyway, who's Trombone Shorty's grandfather. So we're related, and then he was, my Uncle Jesse was very tight with Professor Longhair. Professor Longhair was kind of cool with my family, so they would come, you know, come to the house. Professor Longhair had come to the house, and he played the piano every now and then. And you know, Dr. Johnny, he would also come to the house and play, you know. And but Professor Longhair, he had put a mark in my grandmother's piano. Because when he played, he would kick the side of the piano with, you know, the side of his foot, and he, you know, playing after a while, you know, he just kind of put a gouge in it, and so before Katrina, that piano was still there. It was, you know, and, you know, you could still see the marks where he would play it, and so it was a lot of guys who Oliver Morgan was in Lower Ninth Ward, who shot the La La. There was Fats Domino, of course. It was, you know, and Freddie Domino, and you know, and a lot of guys. Were, you know, there was a lot of music in Lower Ninth, and you know, I was very fortunate that my grandparents' house was a house that always had some music and had a piano, so it was always some stuff going on. So I got to hear a lot of different music as a boy growing up.
Herlin Riley got piano lessons at 10, took up trumpet at 12, and in high school got solid grounding in music fundamentals and theory from great public school music educator Yvonne Bush. Being a professional musician was his sole ambition.
I never dreamed of having another job because my Uncle Melvin was really my mentor. You know, he and Harold Baptiste started the record company, AFO, and all that stuff together. But anyway, he was my mentor, and I saw him working as a musician and really, you know, enjoying his life. He passed away at 42, but I still was enough. I saw enough of him and also my uncles who, you know, my Uncle David and my Uncle Walter were musicians too, but they had other day jobs, you know. But my Uncle Melvin he was only a musician. That's all he did. And so I wanted to be like him, you know, and so music was always a part of me, and I always wanted to be a professional musician, always. And so I'm really living a childhood dream.
In addition to the example of his uncle, Melvin Lasty, Herlin Riley got good guidance in the how-tos of being a professional musician from guitarist, banjoist, and Fairview Baptist Church brass band founder Danny Barker.
Danny Barker talked to us. Myself, you know, I was a part of the Fairview Baptist Church Christian band as boys with Leroy Jones, Dr. Michael White, and Tuba Fats, and Lucian Barberin. And I mean, I'm just naming a few, but Danny Barker was such a strong mentor, and he told us about how to communicate with the people, how to look professional when you're on a job, how to, you know, respect the bandstand, act like you're enjoying what you're doing. Because when you know, and my Uncle Poppy told me this, he said, you know, when you, as a musician, you're a public servant. And so you have to, you know, if you people have made provisions to get to you and, you know, bought a ticket or got a babysitter or got a new outfit or whatever they did to come and see you play, you owe it to them to give your best. And so those are things I took from, you know, my mentors. When I'm on the bandstand, when I'm in front of you, you know, I respect my audience, and I respect them. I respect you enough that I will give you everything I have.
From 1982 to 87, Herlin Riley worked with legendary pianist Ahmad Jamal, then began a 17-year tenure with Wynton Marsalis in Wynton's quintet, sextet, septet, and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. He's toured extensively with McCoy Tyner, and is now on another go-round with Ahmad Jamal. You can catch him leading his own band frequently at Snug Harbor and other venues around the Crescent City. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
You can catch Herlin Riley in performance with his band this Friday night at Snug Harbor. Today's interview with him was made possible in part thanks to support from the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park, which presents the live interview series Talkin' Jazz with Fred Gaston the last Friday afternoon of each month at 2 p.m. in the third floor auditorium of the old U.S. Mint. The series continues with Fred's interview of New Orleans trumpeter and vocalist Wendell Brunius this Friday at 2.
Can I have it in red? Oh, it's such a special occasion.
A special night indeed, as the Ashe Cultural Arts Center celebrates its second annual Red Linen Night, a nod to the Warehouse Arts District's summer celebration known as White Linen Night. But first and foremost, it honors Ashe's late co-founder, Douglas Redd, spelled R-E-D-D. Joining me is Carol Bebel, Ashe's executive director.
It's not a memorial, but it is a celebration of his artistry and his vision and his capacity to be this multidisciplinary artist. The wonderful ways that Ashe looked were all a part of Doug's bringing his talent to bear on that place, so that as people came in, like he said, every time a different person came in, it made it a different place. And so it's that whole concept of bringing together creativity with culture and community that was so much who he was that we're celebrating on this night.
Tell us more about Douglas. Who was he?
Well, Douglas Redd was born in Baton Rouge and was really on his way to the Hampton Institute to study architecture when he got distracted and wound up at Dillard in their arts education program. And so he began to build a practice of working with people who needed graphic work done, also working with the Mardi Gras Indian tradition and also the second line clubs in terms of some of the base artwork that they wound up using before they started beautifying their costumes and all. And then in time, our paths started to cross. We discovered that we both kind of had a hankering for the opportunity to bring this appreciation we had for culture to bear in a stronger way in the community. I'd done 20 years in public sector, and I was about ready to try something different. And he'd been being an individual for hire artist, and he was ready to try to do something bigger. So that's how Ashe happened. Central City, and more importantly, what was the Dried Street Corridor, which is now known as the Retha Castle Haley Corridor, was trying to reinvent itself. It had kind of gone down on its times, and a lot of ideas had come on the table, and they thought that they were good, but they didn't think that they were as good as the original purpose that the boulevard had been, which was that it was a retail district, it was a vibrant cultural district. A lot of activity had gone on there, and they wanted the opportunity to try to bring that back, and they, of course, needed somebody or some institution that would be kind of dedicated in helping to kind of evolve that possibility. So those forces came together in a breakfast one morning where, you know, they were saying, well, won't y'all come and hang out on the boulevard and just use some space we're developing to do some of the things that you're doing? And Doug, because he was a visionary, said, well, why would we want to do that? Let's just get the space. We went to the developer that was doing the property and said, okay, we'll take you up on that deal. What she agreed to do was to let us be there as long as no one else was for free. And all we had to do was to pay our insurance and utilities. When somebody else came in and had to pay rent, we would have to pay rent as well. So we got a 6-month hiatus on paying rent, and we got started building Ashe. And a lot of the building of it was physical building, and Douglas began to do his magic. He took a empty space and essentially started moving it very close to what you see today.
Ashe. A-S-H-E. What does it mean?
Ashe comes from the vocabulary of the people of West Africa. And what it comes closest to meaning is amen. So we pray to God with an understanding that God gets what we're sending forward. And then we just kind of say amen at the end to say, you know, so let it be. And so it's kind of like this, you know, like divine force, the ability to make things happen. And it is kind of who we seek to be in the world. We kind of look to be a make it happen kind of place. We're constantly watching and looking at both what's going on in the world, what's happening in our community, and trying to figure out how is it that we make a difference.
And bearing that in mind and Ashe Cultural Arts Center's vision, how does an event like this one move that forward?
So here we have Red Linen Night, which is like this call and response of sorts. So we have a visual art exhibit that we put up, and then we get the artist to then meet performing artists who see what the artist has done, the visual artist has done, and then they go back and create a performance as a response to the visual art piece. And so on the night of Red Linen, what will happen is that the exhibit, of course, will be opened, but people will get to see the performances that were inspired by the visual art pieces. That's the twist. It's not just about the visual artwork. It's about the visual artwork in its amplified power, because it's the visual artwork and its ability to influence the creation of yet another artwork. And it is a way to really kind of understand how we kind of play off of each other all the time. And so it's going to be a great evening of poetry, music, dance, and visual art.
A lot can be said for the power of art.
Oh, for sure.
Now, what do you think Douglas Redd would say about this event and the progress made by Ashe, which is now a beacon in Central City?
Well, I think he'd be terribly proud. I think that he'd probably say, damn, you know. And for him, it would be the look on his face and the way that he said it that would have you to understand that some of it was, I thought that this could happen, and there was a part of me that wasn't sure, and it happened. All of that would be inside of that, damn, man, a few words.
Beautifully said. Now, I know that Red Linen Night is named for Douglas Redd,
correct.
R-E-D-D.
Yeah.
But it begs the question, do we wear red linen?
For sure, for sure. We're asking everybody to flag their wear that night with red.
All right, Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Carol Bebel, Executive Director of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center. The second annual Red Linen Night celebration is Saturday, February 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, 1724 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. More info about the visual and performing artist is online at ashecac.com. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.